This is an ABC podcast.
China is refusing to budge on its COVID zero policy, even as lockdown frustration grows in Shanghai.
For these Shanghai residents, a trip downstairs for COVID testing is the only outing they're allowed. Some have been in lockdown for up to 5 weeks, while tens of thousands of people have been forced into mandatory quarantine centres.
China's COVID zero policy has forced shutdowns in key commercial cities like Shanghai and Shenzhen, sparking fears of slowing growth and sending commodity prices plunging.
China, unlike most of the world, is sticking to its zero COVID policy. Over the past few months, it's locked down several major cities, forcing millions of people to stay home and shutting major industries and transport hubs. Despite the economic and social impact, the Chinese leadership seems unfazed by the slowing economy and the disruption to global supply chains. Hello, this is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince. In this program, the story of why the Chinese leadership is sticking to zero COVID, while the rest of the world is learning to live with the virus. China has been dealing with the virus longer than any other nation, and for most of the past 2 years, it successfully stopped the spread and limited the number of deaths. And in a nation with a population of over 1.4 billion, it's been an impressive achievement. But the arrival of the Omicron variant at the end of 2021 has made eliminating the virus much, much harder. But let's begin at the beginning, Wuhan at the end of 2019.
Authorities in China have dramatically scaled up the number of people infected with the new virus, announcing a third death and a total of almost 200 cases.
So far, three people have died from this new coronavirus. At least seven are in a critical condition, but authorities say others only had mild symptoms and recovered. The virus originated from an animal and seafood market in the central city of Wuhan.
In the very, very beginning, in the first weeks from late December through into late January, they weren't very effective. And as we know, there was an attempted cover-up of what was going on, probably mostly instigated by the local authorities there. I'm Jane Duckett, Edward Caird Chair of Politics at the University of Glasgow and Director of the Scottish Centre for China Research. But from the 20th of January, the government did recognise the seriousness of the situation, and it did, on the 23rd of January, lock down Wuhan. And thereafter, we saw this highly concentrated effort around the city of Wuhan and Hubei in particular to contain the virus, to stop the spread. The rest of the country was put on high alert as well to basically track people coming from Wuhan and Hubei and isolate and prevent the spread. So those efforts were, by late March, successful. They actually managed to contain that original strain of the virus. And the deaths in Wuhan were, although probably higher than reported, were still not as high as we've seen elsewhere in the world. And they brought the deaths to zero, they brought the infections to zero, and then they managed thereafter, through 2021, to continue to contain subsequent outbreaks in different parts of the country as well.
So it started with decision by President Xi to lock down Wuhan and started to implement decisive measures, including the quarantine, close contact tracing, and also the mass COVID testing. My name is Yanzhong Huang. I'm a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm also a professor at Seton Hall University School of Diplomacy and International Relations. These measures were effective indeed in containing the spread of the virus, especially after they managed to build those emergency hospitals and also those makeshift hospitals to admit both the severe cases and those that show, you know, only mild symptoms. So by beginning in mid-February, the cases peaked and started to taper off. And by early April, it was clear the situation was under control, so that lockdown was lifted on April 8th, 2020.
By the middle of 2020, life for most people in China had returned to normal, and the economy had bounced back.
That's right. The Chinese economy bounced back quite quickly in 2020. Most people did return to relatively normal life, and some people had not really had their lives disrupted much at all, because even in the early phase, many parts of China weren't directly affected. So yes, through most of that period from sort of mid-2020 through to early 2022 or late 2021, life was quite normal for many people, most of the population, except for travel restrictions and the quite lengthy quarantine procedures that were in place for people coming into China from outside, up to 3 weeks sometimes.
Now, that's a very different picture to what you saw in Western countries, say the UK, across Europe and into America during that period, wasn't it?
It was. And I think this forms part of the reason why the policies are as they are now. For this quite extended period, China looked very successful and was the big success case. Really very low death rates, given the size of the population. You know, the number of deaths per head of population was extremely low. Outbreaks were contained. And meanwhile, you had soaring death rates in places like the UK and the US. And so the Chinese government probably did quite rightly feel that they'd shown they had the capacity to deal with this. They argued that this showed the superiority of their political system, and they were very critical of what was happening elsewhere. And they did make a lot in their own media of the problems elsewhere in the world and how this contrasted with what they had successfully achieved.
In 2021, there was a sort of mutual reinforcement between the wider Chinese public and the Chinese government. The Chinese government put forward some highly harsh measures, but ones that were pretty successful in terms of locking down the virus or removing the virus from large parts of the lived environment of many, many Chinese. And by the middle of that year, there were scenes of people having street parties, which were in some ways rather gleefully broadcast to the Western world, which still had a lot of its population under lockdown during the middle of that period. I'm Rana Mitter, and I'm Professor of the History and Politics of Modern China at Oxford University. There is evidence, particularly through opinion poll surveys, which are obviously problematic in an authoritarian state like China, but they do exist and they do give us some indications of where people's minds are, that there was a feeling that, yes, actually, the Chinese government has proved its case, that actually we, the public, have been kept safe in a way that we can see on television or on the internet is not happening in Western Europe or in North America. And for that reason, I think that that tended to sort of reflect back that the government felt that they were actually getting a genuinely quite positive vibe back from the population, and therefore felt more and more confident that whatever measures they put forward were going to ultimately be approved by the population and indeed be successful. There's nothing like success to make you think that the next thing you do in a sort of linear succession is also going to be successful. And China's COVID policy has very much been along those lines, in a sense, because it hasn't had the hesitancy and the reverse turns that some Western countries have had. They have got into a mindset where I think for a very long time, the thinking was that everything was going on a straight line towards exiting lockdown.
Like the rest of the world, China began looking for a COVID vaccine. The vaccines they came up with, inactivated vaccines, used a traditional method, like, for example, the vaccine for rabies. But they have proved to be less effective than the newer mRNA vaccines, like Pfizer and Moderna.
China has reportedly administered more than 160 million doses of its vaccines and is aiming to inoculate 40% of its 1.4 billion population by the middle of the year. But the country's top disease control official, Gao Fu, has raised the prospect of changing the dosing regime after acknowledging concerns about the effectiveness of the homegrown shots.
Before the highly transmissible Delta variant became the dominant variant in the world, if you compare the efficacy rate of the Chinese inactivated vaccines and that of the mRNA vaccines in the West, was clear that they were inferior to the mRNA vaccines in terms of efficacy rates. But still, it was able to have like 50% efficacy rate in terms of preventing infections. But when the highly transmissible Delta variant, then the Omicron variant hit, these inactive vaccines, their efficacy rate dropped significantly. Studies now show that the Chinese inactive vaccines basically are ineffective in preventing infections. Even though three doses, according to a study from Hong Kong, three doses of the Chinese inactive vaccines can significantly reduce the risk of severe cases and death.
What about the rollout of these vaccines across China's 1.4 billion population? How effective has that been?
So first of all, they focused on frontline workers. And this was at a time in 2021 when, for China, the main risk of the virus spreading was from contact from people who were out doing things, you know, out working on the front lines and so forth. And usually these outbreaks, as I've said, were contained. And so they focused on those kind of people, people who might be in hospitals, working in hospitals in particularly, people working in airports, people where who might be exposed to the virus coming in from outside. And that was the priority initially. And that contrasts with many other parts of the world where the focus was very much on the elderly and on people who were vulnerable for other health reasons. But it did have a logic to it in the context of the virus having been contained and the outbreaks being containable and contained at that point. And so relatively few people being exposed, and elderly and vulnerable people less likely to be exposed to the virus at that point.
So have we got a sort of clear picture of how many people have been vaccinated in China today?
We don't get regular detailed information about patterns of vaccination. The Chinese state does release every day the total number of vaccinated people, but it doesn't tell you the patterns usually across the population. But they have at times released that information. So we do get a picture occasionally. And what we've been seeing recently from the data they have sometimes released is the sort of inverse pattern of what you get in at least European countries, where we have the older you are, the more likely you are to be fully vaccinated and boosted. In China, the opposite is the case. The older you are, the less likely you are to be fully vaccinated or even have had one dose as compared with the rest of the population. And that does create this problem for the leadership, for the country, that those people are still vulnerable if there is an outbreak of the virus.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince. And today we're asking why the Chinese leadership is sticking to a COVID zero policy while the rest of the world is learning to live with the virus. The vulnerability of China's population, especially its elderly, has been tested since the emergence of the highly transmittable Omicron variant in November 2021.
It was not until November 2021 they started to talk about promoting the vaccination of the elderly population, those who are aged over 60. So that becomes the problem for China's pandemic response because, first of all, it was unable to achieve the herd immunity given those ineffectiveness of the inactivated vaccines. And secondly, it sustained those immunity gap between China and rest of the world because you have a large percentage of population, more than 50 million elderly people who are not fully vaccinated. So you had a large vulnerable population that were either not exposed to the virus, thanks to that zero COVID strategy, or because of the lack of effectiveness of their vaccines, the low immunity level, even among the vaccinated population. So as a result, the emphasizing, right, those heavy-handed measures like mass PCR testing, aggressive contact tracing and quarantine, and also the lockdown measures.
For much of the world, scenes of strict lockdowns and harsh restrictions are a thing of the past, but not in China. The country remains one of the few places with a COVID zero policy, and with the Beijing Winter Olympics just 1 month away, no chances are being taken to allow the virus to spread.
2 weeks into another drastic lockdown, case numbers are starting to drop in China. 13 million people in the ancient city of Xi'an are still confined to their homes, not allowed to leave to buy food or supplies. Residents have been complaining about not getting help and claim busloads of people are being rounded up from housing compounds and forced into quarantine facilities. This woman says she and 80 others in her building were taken from their homes.
We're residents of Tower 4, but when we arrived, there was no room here. We've been waiting in the freezing wind for hours.
The arrival of the Omicron virus at the end of 2021 and running, of course, well into 2022 has marked, I think, a real divergence between China and the rest of the world. This isn't even, I think, a divergence between China and the West. It's really China and almost every other country in the world. Initially, when Omicron arrived, many people, including here in the UK, where I'm talking to you from, and in Australia and in the United States, feared that this might be the next really, really dangerous strain. And China had the same sense of that, of course. But it rapidly became clear that for people who had been fully vaccinated, particularly with the Western vaccines, that actually for many of those, Omicron was, of course, annoying. And in many cases, it could be dangerous. But on the other hand, it was far less so than the Delta strain of the virus, which had been more prevalent in the months preceding that. And at that point, as is now well known, most of the rest of the world, including Australia, including Britain, decided just to open up and live with the virus one way or another. And there's no doubt that death rates have gone up, but because of vaccination, they have not gone up in a sort of exponential way as compared to a year previously. China has decided that even Omicron, which with full injection would be probably less dangerous, needs to be contained. And hence they have turned back to the policy of lockdowns once again. I think there are probably two main reasons for this. The first is actually a medical one, which is that because the Chinese vaccines have just not been as effective in the population as the Western ones, it means that even a widely vaccinated population could be more vulnerable to Omicron, which is dangerous to the unvaccinated. But the other reason is political. At the moment, China's leadership and President Xi Jinping in particular have really tied their policy flag to the idea of what they call zero COVID. In other words, that China will essentially stamp out every single case of COVID, whatever variant, however mild, and make sure that China is a COVID-free country. And while during the initial period of the pandemic, while the borders were literally closed, this proved, if not absolutely feasible, at least, you know, very close to being feasible, with Omicron, which spreads so fast, it is proving very, very difficult to manage because it spreads quickly. But also the use of that particular policy is less obvious because Omicron is also milder. And that, I think, is leading to a lot of questioning as to whether or not this is really the right way to go, leading to a lot of protests, for instance, on social media in China, much of which has been censored very quickly, but it's still available and visible through people who have managed to get some of these social media messages to the outside world.
After 6 weeks enduring Shanghai's strict lockdown, Nicholas Oettinger has had enough. The Australian businessman has lived in China for 15 years, but says the mental strain of COVID measures is too much to bear.
There is no end in sight, and the psychological challenge of every day working to get food, every day just trying to make sure that you don't mix with the right person, that there's no opening up plan.
The effects were clearly very, very serious for many people, ranging from very small children, even under the age of two, being separated from their parents, if the parents were taken into isolation. Of course, worst of all, people dying from the consequences of the lockdown rather than from COVID itself, ranging from accounts of people who commit suicide for various reasons because of the restrictions, either because they're not able to get the medication that they need for their mental health problem, or because they're in great pain with some chronic or terminal illness and can't get to a hospital for treatment. So we've seen terribly tragic stories. And some netizens in Shanghai were trying to put together accounts of this sort to calculate the number of deaths, not because of the virus itself, but because of these restrictions. And at the last count, there were around 200 people who, it seemed, had died in some way because of the restrictions that were in place across the city.
The government is trying to blunt the economic hit. Factories in Shanghai are restarting, but most workers will have to live on site, and global supply chains are rattled.
The lockdown of Shanghai is having really significant ripple effects throughout the wider society. Just to take a couple of quick examples, China's still very dependent on getting its exports up. It's always been a big exporting country in the last 30, 40 years, as we know. But because Shanghai's container port is essentially subject to sudden and unpredictable opening and shutting, it means that global shipping flows are really being disrupted. Supply chains for, you know, components, say, for computers or for high technology, which come from China, all of these have suddenly become part of a very unpredictable supply chain. And of course, it affects the rest of the world. But Shanghai itself finds that the orders aren't coming in or can't be fulfilled, and then workers can't be paid. One of China's vice premiers, Hu Chunhua, who's a man who's tipped to potentially move up at the big party congress that takes place later this year, has been making noises. Obviously, they're quite discreet, quite polite noises, but they're quite noticeable about the need to avoid mass unemployment, which, of course, could lead to labor unrest. So there's a real fear that the price of this particular disruption might be more unemployment than people protesting in the streets. So there's lots of signs that the specific occasion of Shanghai being locked down is having ripple effects way across China towards the top leadership, and even in terms of China's international relations and commercial relations as well.
If the zero COVID policy is having detrimental social and economic impacts, why is the Chinese leadership sticking with it?
Well, they're justifying the zero COVID policy on two fronts. Number one, the public health front. Basically, they don't want to move away from the approach for fear of this worst case scenario, in which a policy relaxation could lead to spike of cases that overwhelm the country's healthcare system, and that in turn also leads to mass die-off, you know, that even cause threats to social political stability. There's also number two, right, that is the political justification. They just don't want to give way half through those achievements they made in the first 2 years of the pandemic response. And just a month away from the 20th Party Congress, they don't want any surprises that derail the leadership transition process. And in the meantime, because President Xi himself has invested so heavily in the zero COVID policy, because he's making it very clear that he's in command of China's pandemic response. So a perceived failure of zero COVID, or admitting failure of zero COVID policy, could undermine his personal leadership, if not regime legitimacy.
The zero COVID policy has become more and more personally associated with Xi Jinping as the president of China, the general secretary of the Communist Party, the chairman of the Central Military Commission. In other words, the person who has centralized most control under himself. For that reason, I think it's still fair to say that he probably has his hands on almost all of the levers of power in China if he wants to exercise them. But there's no doubt that this policy in particular is not working out the way that I think the leadership would have hoped when they put their trust in zero COVID as the way forward. So I think in this particular case, it's right to say that ahead of the party congress, we don't know exactly what the date is, probably October, even November sometime, but it's a big event held only every 5 years, and it will mark some change in the leadership. For instance, there'll probably be a new prime minister of China, but Xi Jinping wants, in a way that's unprecedented in the modern era, to take a third term, having done two terms already, 10 years in total. He'd like to take it up to at least 15. Now, I think the likelihood that if he had to reverse policy on zero COVID before the Congress, that would be compatible with a message of stern an unswaying leadership that doesn't change its mind is quite hard to see, even in an authoritarian society. And I think, you know, one little straw in the wind that we see that China isn't looking to open up anytime soon is that within the last few days, it's announced that it's not going to hold the 2023 Asian football games, which had been scheduled for China for next year. And it's clear that unlike the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, which they managed to get through earlier this year, they clearly feel it's too great a risk to be allowing footballers and audiences and fans into China, even a year from now, which is essentially when the contest would take place. So I think that that football signal is one that suggests that this policy is one that is not going to change anytime soon if the top leadership have anything to do with it.
The impact on the economy at the moment is really severe. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party, many believe, has really staked its reputation and in a sense has derived its legitimacy from its economic performance, for its ability to raise living standards over the last few decades and its ability to provide employment and better livelihoods for people. So if we see a sustained period of economic problems, you know, it really is challenging the fundamentals of what we think has been any base of support for the party and for the political system. So from another point of view, the question is China's relationship with the rest of the world, if it continues to be relatively isolated, if the economic impacts on manufacturing carry on, does China become more isolated from the world economy? Does it start to really kind of withdraw economically as well? That's a potential problem, I think, or potential trajectory that it could be on, but that would be economically damaging as well. So it is very difficult for, I think, the leadership at the moment, given the vaccination situation, the patterns of vaccination is in a very difficult position because its legitimacy to us, if you can talk about legitimacy, is both based on now its ability to contain the virus and on the economy, but it can't really successfully promote both of those at the moment. That really puts it in a difficult position.
There's no doubt that the economic bargain, the idea that life will get better year by year, decade by decade, has been one powerful factor in keeping the rule of the Chinese Communist Party going in China. Yes, it's an authoritarian state, but it's also a consumerist state. And at least for its rapidly growing middle class, the capacity to provide everything from luxury vacations to nice automobiles to snazzy mobile phones has been a really strong part of showing a message which by implication, never stated this way, but the implication is we are not the old Soviet Union of the Cold War days that had nuclear weapons but couldn't give its people decent transport or apartments. China is a country that at least can show that sort of consumerist dream to its wider population. But if things go wrong, and there is the possibility, of course, that a global recession could affect China in a very, very serious way in the next few months, even, I think that there are also other levers that China can pull, in particular, the pull of a quite strong and in many ways, very assertive sounding nationalism is something that you see more and more. You see more and more on Chinese television and the media discussions about how the outside world, in particular the United States, is clearly out to try and contain China. And I think that there is a sense in which encouraging social media, encouraging that public sphere in China that exists on the internet to be very, very much pro the idea of China being more assertive in the world is seen as a sort of alternative pathway if the economic story doesn't hold up as strongly. So I think the ideological as well as the economic are going to be part of the policy mix that the party uses.
Rana Mitter, Professor of History and Politics of Modern China at Oxford University. Today's other guests, Yang Zhonghuang, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Jane Ducker, Chair of Politics at the University of Glasgow and Director of the Scottish Centre for Chinese Research. The sound engineer is John Jacobs. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.